Martha and I didn't have any shared words on what I might do with the chapter, and I appreciate it because I'm going to deconstruct it. So I was very nervous about the fact that I was going to do that, since Richard Rohr is also held in such high esteem here. But I'm also going to talk about classical Jungian thought and where first half of life, is in that. But I want to start out with a story, and I'm going to ask Tom to be a foil for me in the story. I hope to come back toward the very end of our morning to comment a little bit more on the story. But I have to say a little bit before. Okay. I have a stepson. He's about 54. He lives in Australia right now. And when I came into the family, he was like 13. His mom had died, and some of you even know Steve. Somehow or the other, the tradition started with, when could Steve beat me at arm wrestling? You know? Okay? So he's 13 years old, and I am endowed with more than fat. And it wasn't until he was 16 that I could beat him. So then that became a tradition in the George family into the grandkids. Micaiah, who is the first grandson, is now 32. And it was I think he beat Steve maybe by a month or so in arm wrestling. And then Jeremiah, and then all the girls in New Zealand. Actually, the youngest one beat me at 13. She was a tough little gal, and still is. At any rate, this summer when I was down there, I said, Steve, for old time's sake, let's arm wrestle. And he was embarrassed, of course, you know. And so I'm asking Tom to come up here and demonstrate with me what happened. Okay? So we were at table and we went like this, you know, and we started and I started.
Come on, Tom.
Okay. And that was it. Now, I want a couple of observations from you as to what you saw there. Notice I didn't ask one of the women to come up and demonstrate this.
Good job, Tom.
Good job, Tom. What else can you say?
The first thing I can say is I'm a wimp.
A balance in masculine and feminine.
No. And do you think that was by design or consciousness, or do you think that was unconscious?
Conscious.
A conscious plan,
yeah.
Right? And anything else somebody could say?
A threat kind of by the female.
Yeah. Actually, when I did it with Steve, I wasn't grimacing. I think I was trying to play to the house just then. But I did use all of my energy, and my energy grew, and I felt good. And just before we arm wrestled, a light went on in Steve's face, Steve's mind. And it was, I know how I can do this. I will give Dawn a thrill, but I won't bruise, I won't crush the bruise reed. Which is really part of Steve's personality. You know, he didn't play weak, but he clearly was at the fullness of his strength, but did not use all of it. Do you know what I mean? You can be at the fullness without using it all. So I was sort of impressed with that, his generosity. And it took about a month before I thought, ask this question of my husband. I mean, a month after that event happened, and I said, who taught men how not to use all of their strength when they're with women? Now, we know some do, you know, but by and far, most of us are in contact with men who have all of this energy that they restrain. Mm-hmm. And so Don engaged the question. He says, well, it's different if men are with men and men are with women. And when men are with men, they're going to go all out, you know, and maybe women playing basketball do also. But they learn early. So I said, how do they learn? Because, see, one of my problems is I don't know when to stop. Not with physical energy, but with other energy. I give information when people don't even want it. And I became really jealous of the fact that men, ever since they're little boys, somebody told them, you know, you don't have to win every physical fight. You don't have to beat up your sisters. You know, be gentle with the baby. They learn that. And no one seems to tell women when they get pushy, you know, you can enjoy your strength without going too far. So that's my first homage to the men here. Because I'm really pleased that this place, which has given me so much, is evidently a place for the men who come here, which come in larger proportions than in most things we do together, I guess I want to say we ladies like to have you here. So from there, where can I go? Well, first I want to say the arm wrestling is a metaphor and also a meme for the session, for this time. And I would encourage any time you want to use the metaphor, never to use the word just a metaphor. As one of my teachers at Pacifica told me, metaphor is what is. A concrete example is the just. So metaphor is what is. And if there's a concrete example like this, that's a just. It's just an example. And a meme is like a little teeny bit of real life. You could say a myth is a long piece, a long narrative of real life. And we often cut up a myth into little pieces. And so a meme is just a little motion, a little snippet. And I want to mine that later on. But first of all, I want to go back to classical Jungian theory and the schema we have on the board. I don't see it by any means without merit, but I also feel, especially after last year when we spent the time with Naked Now, that it's, I don't know when Rohr wrote the book, but this book goes back to a lot of dualistic stuff. This is very dualistic, and hopefully we can see where it is and how we could reimagine things in a way that's not nearly so clear. Like if we know, you know? Okay, so what this illustration was an illustration devised by a Jungian from England called Michael Fordham. And it was published in Edward Edinger's book, Ego and Archetype. And what Jung had said, and this illustration was to illustrate Jung's statement that we can't surrender an ego until we have one. You know? Okay, we can't surrender an ego till we have one. By the way, the word ego in Jungian thought is not a dirty word. It's a very good word, you know. It's not the whole story, but it's a good word. So the idea here is that when we're born, the ego is totally unconscious. We don't have any sense of I. And so there is, in Jungian thought, this notion that deep within our consciousness, there is a voice of wisdom and love and knowledge that he says is phenomenologically the same as God. Phenomenologically meaning, from all appearances, it's the same as God. So the ego and the self coincide. And so at birth, to whatever extent there is any coming out of that unconsciousness to a place of I-ness, which is ego-ness, that there is, because so much is in the unconscious Godhead, there's a sense of omnipotence and entitlement. And we know that that is, for the most part, true. Infants are little tyrants. They're, you know, they, we sort of almost respond to them as though they're little gods. And, you know, their cry is in our brains and their little eyes so big in their face that we are helpless in their presence but to attend to them. Okay. All right, so that's birth. Then we come along, and through the first years, the first half of life, through the first years, the ego starts to emerge out of unconsciousness and is very conscious. And it might be conscious in the form of, I hurt, I'm hungry, I can do this, you know, I can flush rubber ducky down the toilet. You know, there is a sense of that. But, well, where in this diagram, the center being down here was done deliberately, there is much more unconscious part of the human being than conscious. And so there is a lot of grandiosity, a lot of borrowed God attributes, and they're attributed to oneself, you know, at that place. You know, I mean, to some extent, we can say that's a lot of the human condition. I don't know if you've ever heard the 12 steps described to the whole human race. And it's like the first step is, I've come to the awareness that my life is out of control due to the fact that I'm a human. You know, that it is certainly specific, and I don't want to take away from how the 12 steps have been helpful for alcoholics. The first step would be something like, I've come to the awareness that my life is out of control due to my use of alcohol or of spending or of drugs, you know, or of pornography on the internet. But we could say that to some extent of all of us, that our life's under control due to the fact that I'm a human. But that's especially when we expect still, because so much of us is sunk in this notion, in this self, that we, our entitlement is very, very high. And so therefore we get pained any time we don't live up to our innate godness. You know. Okay, then we come on over, and this would be as we pass from, you know, adolescence, say, into midlife, and this is now starting to be the, you know, where we are now able to start to develop what is referred to in the literature as the ego-self axis. And this is like the beginning of surrendering, which would be the third step in AA, which is, you know, second is I believe in a power greater than myself. And the third step, and I surrender my life to that power, whoever and whatever it is. So this begins the process of doing that, and then the fourth step, which would be abstractly a goal, but is not, you know, going to be possible because some part of us is always going to be unconscious. But this is what's called the ego axis. And in Jungian work, what you do is, in working from here to here, you try to find all the things that are still unconscious, and they would have names like anima and shadow, and more and more now there's not just an anima for a man and an animus for a male, but both for each person. And then maybe other unknown contents that we can begin to relate to, and that would be like the wise person, the hurt child, largely material that's unconscious, but we can bring to consciousness by some form of relating, and that might be done in journal work, it might be done in artwork. Jung himself did a lot of it through art. It might be done with music, and so then, you know, one would be constantly working toward this. Okay. Any questions on that? Any comment? Okay, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I like things messier than this now, all right? Because, well, let me go ahead to this diagram and make some of those comments. Another diagram that's often used to represent the first and second half of life is this sinusoidal, the sine wave curve, where it rises up to a zenith, a high point, and then starts going down. And that the idea is that, oh, along around midlife, we have to come to terms with our finiteness in a way we didn't earlier, because some things don't work as well, or in less than, you know, physical ways, we become aware that in a rather dramatic way that we're not God, you know, as this merges out more. And so we have to sort of give up the fantasy that we have certain powers that we might have thought we had. Now, so this is one kind of diagram we'll use the rest of the day, but I also want to give another diagram which I think has actually some enhancement over that one. And it's this, it's the ordinary sine wave reversed so that we go down before you go up. And you'd say, well, I'm born here, and from here on down, I'm going down, and then I'm going up again. What would that mean? Well, I claim that this is really a fairly good image of one of my favorite verses in Scripture, Philippians 2. In Philippians 2, Paul says, and Jesus, I think, not sure if he says Jesus, but I think the Christ, though being equal to God, gave up godness, becoming human in all things, except sin, he says. And then, therefore, God gave him a name above all names, under which every knee will bow, and, you know, restored him to this place. Well, this curve, I think, is a curve that describes something that we often don't celebrate, or we don't take into account the difficultiness of it, and that is becoming incarnated. This kind of a view, the view of looking at the life course as a process of going down into flesh, and then, following Richard Rohr's title, you know, falling upward, is that once you get down and you're really incarnated, you know, after you're down, there's no way but up, is to learn how to be like the angels, that is, fly because they hold themselves lightly. So from here on, it's a process of learning how to hold oneself lightly. Not find ourselves wounded so much when we find the incarnation we have acquired has let us down or has limited us in any of the many ways it does. This particular notion of becoming incarnated is one that is often at the very core of the work I do in therapy, because I think that becoming flesh or becoming human is the first part of the journey. And we learn it very incrementally. In my office, I have a picture which environment just would not particularly like, other than if they appreciate art. And is I have a very nice reproduction of the capture of the unicorn. You know, the series is in the cloisters, and they're a medieval series. But this particular one, which is, I think, either the last or the second to last, you have a unicorn seated next to a tree, like the tree of life. And what is around it? But a fence. And so you see this and you say, you know, why are you fencing in that beautiful unicorn? Well, for the medievalist, it was the best way they could express the notion of our pure spirit, okay, becoming incarnated, that it was, the unicorn was their symbol of the spirit. And remember, that only a virgin could tame it. There was a lot of other things to the myth of the unicorn, things that I don't particularly remember. But the notion that we have to learn how to, we have to tolerate being incarnated, I think it can be captured in a little incident. I had a little encounter, or maybe as much as 30 years ago. I was sitting next to a young woman who was very visibly pregnant at a conference. And so I, you know, said some kind of like appropriate things, and, you know, when are you expecting the baby and all the rest? And, you know, sort of expecting a fair amount of joy on her part. And she says, no, no, I'm so conflicted. And so I said, well, what, you know, tell me. And she said, before this baby was even conceived, I had an infinite number of choices from which to draw about my baby. And as it gets closer and closer, and she was being quite concrete and uninhibited, she says, I'm going to be stuck with one face and one gender and one personality. That's incarnation. And it's hard for us to recognize both the limits of that and the opportunity of that. Okay. I'll leave that at that point. And again, if it's something that you want to pursue, we can do that in the questions afterwards. So going back to this particular kind of diagram, the diagram of the normal first half of the sine wave, a sort of a wave that crests and comes back down to like a zero point, that this also very much follows the outline of the hero's journey. The hero, you know, just increases in strength and he fights the fight of the of the Iliad. You know, he fights that war in which they're winners. And the second half being the journey back home, which as from the 2 weeks ago, the notion of the Odyssey, of gradually losing all of the ships, losing all of the sailors and returning home alone. So it's pretty much that myth. Campbell, who wrote the book Hero with a Thousand Faces, is actually not particularly esteemed in the mythological world because he is what is called a monomythic person. And a monomythic person looks at all of mythology through one lens, the myth of the hero. But there are lots of other myths, lots and lots. And he might stretch a little to fit some into this particular mode, but there are lots that couldn't be fit in. And for example, there is the myth of Psyche, who has four trials before she is able to marry Eros and be happy ever after. And the last of her trials for Psyche, a woman, is she has to refuse to give help to anybody else. Now, that would not be the last thing a man has to learn to do, in spite of what I said. Because often women develop the empathic quality, the altruistic quality earlier, and as Richard Rohr mentioned in this chapter, he said, sadly, they're not able, to do it. I wouldn't say sadly. I'd say they're just halfway through. They haven't learned Psyche's last story, which is the story of the, I'll tell you that little snippet because it's so wonderful. I have a very dear friend, and she wouldn't finish her dissertation. And if I told you the story already, I apologize. We'd go to parties, and she'd get more attention for not finishing her dissertation than her two friends, me being one, for finishing. She sort of sucked up all the air. Well, we didn't like that. So we took her aside and we had a, what do you call that thing? Intervention. We called it that. Yeah, and we had with us two loaves of bread. Now, in the myth, Psyche is given two loaves of bread because what she's supposed to do is cross the river Styx, that's the entrance to hell, and get the beauty box for, what was the old gal, the goddess of beauty. Venus, yes, Aphrodite, I was looking for the Greek name, Greek guy. And so she had to go over there to get that box. And the reason she had two loaves was she had to throw one to the three-headed dog Cerberus on the way over and throw the other one to the dogs on the way back. Okay? And she was told, you need these. You need these loaves. So if anybody comes to you before you get to the river Styx and they want you to help and you're going to put down these loaves, now, this is your journey right now. So what we did with her to make it real, we had two loaves of bread. She had them in her hand. And each of us would go up to her. There were about seven of us there. Each of us would go up to her and say, oh, I don't want to mention her name. Sweetie, I have a big problem. Could you give me an hour or two so I could talk it out? And she'd have to say, no, I cannot do this. And so we went like that. And it was, we, like in an intervention, we told her we would not participate in play with her until we knew she was writing, finishing the work. And she did finish it. Many years ago. But there are times, especially in the lives of women, in what might be called the first half, that you have got to learn the word no. That is, you have to recognize that you can't put off any longer. So some things that you need to do for yourself, whatever they might be, you know. Because for often for women, but also I think for feeling type men, they cannot bear the feeling that they are rejected for not giving. And I would say the women and the feeling type men have got to trust that the people in their lives are there with them, whether or not they are able to reciprocate at that time, that they might have something to do they have to do. I think to some extent in my marriage with Don, when I decided, I'm not a feeling type woman, but I decided I needed to do the doctorate. I already had the master's and had a practice. He didn't particularly want me to do that, you know, and I knew that. And so I went ahead one day. I got the sense this is what I needed to do, and I went and registered and paid my bucks and everything before I told him. Not because he would have said no, but because I didn't want to be diverted from something I needed. I needed a psychic strength to do. So let's see where we are here now and the time. Good. Okay. So over here, let me just say this particular one in which we have the flip of the sine curve, so it goes down first and then comes back up, that is really very much another kind of pattern that's referred to in Roar, and like the Night Sea Journey. The Night Sea Journey or the Dark Night of the Soul, in which you could say nothing really of much worth has happened until one has done that, gone through the Night Sea Journey. My dissertation for Pacific is a very different place. And so even though I was getting a degree in clinical psychology, I did my dissertation on Hamlet. The only thing is I did it on Hamlet, looked at through a non-dualistic lens, different versions of Jungian theory. And Freud is famous for saying that Hamlet failed because he took, you know, four acts to finally kill off the old man. But in a Jungian world, it takes that long, and a Night Sea Journey, which happens in, I guess, the end of the third, fourth act, where Hamlet actually leaves Denmark and is marooned and has to come back, much like Odysseus does with nothing. But he comes back and he now engages the story of whether or not he's going to revenge his father's death by killing his uncle. He says a line, and it's my favorite line in the whole play, and I think it's maybe a line that's suitable for the second half of life in general, and it is, "The readiness is all." The readiness is all. It's not, you know, doing the deed. It's not thinking about the deed. It's being ready. Being ready. Okay. So, there. Now, the problem with this theory, sorry, there's one thing I want to say beforehand. In the first half of life, we have time up until teens. Then we have the teens' years, going up to, say, about 25. In a lot of work, midlife would be around 25, but we push it to 40 now because our lifespan's so much longer. That process here that we have of this sine curve is also a diagram of something else. And it is the diagram of the myelinization of the prefrontal cortex. Okay? The prefrontal cortex is where nearly, well, lots happens there, but it's where the ability to look ahead into the future, problem solve, sacrifice near values for distant, immediate rewards, for long distance rewards. It's ones that let us take other people's feelings and thoughts deeply into account before exercising our own. And what happens at this time, the teen years, is that we have all of these neurons and we have them all sort of connected. But the neurons themselves are not coated with something called myelin, which allows the charge to go through. It's like you could try to do what you want to do if you, but the current doesn't flow. And I think, I'm doing this maybe for a little bit of a laugh, but in the diagram they say the myelinization, you know, starts in the teen years and goes on up till about 25, and then guess what happens? These functions start to go back down. So that it's almost like if, when we're talking about second half of life, maybe we're also talking about how do we cope with other stuff happening in the brain in which it doesn't work as well as it does at 25. I have a personal example in that I came at 33 to UCSB to do a doctorate in mathematics. And in a short time, I discovered I was too old. The brain hookup that's needed to do abstract and pure mathematics is best if it's put into practice at about 20, 21. In the PhD program, and UCSB, it's pure mathematics. It's not like applied math, which is, you have a longer bit of time. Pure mathematics, the people who were in the degree by far were undergraduates in the School of Creative Study. In our classes, most of the seats were taken by undergraduates. You know, well, that is humbling. Luckily, this is not a diagram for all of our functions, and people who work with the neurons and neurology find out that some things actually don't peak till much later. Oh, like wisdom and word use, subtlety, you know, so actually they're peaking for other qualities much later on. So now, problems with this theory. Well, one is that it is pretty dualistic. Where is the whole in every part in those diagrams? You know, where is the whole in the non-dualistic idea is, you know, there wouldn't be this strong first and strong second half. It wouldn't be as though all the goodies we're going to learn or difficulties of giving up self in the second half of life, those are happening in the first half of life. You know, I never had the privilege of rearing kids, but I tell you, I know from people who talk with me, you have your comeuppance with your kids. I do remember my stepdaughter Kathy, who was dying to have this baby, and she had it as a single mother. And there she was one day trying to change his diapers, and he was all over the place. And she said, "You see it? I can't handle a boy, you know." And I was starting to take psychology, so I knew a little bit, not from personal experience. So I went behind her and just held her, soothed her, and said, you know, that kind of get a hold of yourself before you get a hold of your kid. She calmed down, And I'm not kidding. She calmed down, and he, who was on the floor, calmed down without any direct words from her to him. Mm-hmm. He could feel her body in distress, and so he escalated it. Mm-hmm. So I guess basically what I'd say is, what, in fact, maybe I will write Richard Rohr sometime and say, you know, give up some of the Jungian stuff and go and learn some attachment theory. Because attachment theory, which is so neurologically correlated, talks about regulation of the self, not by conscious thought. You see, here, this idea of things being unconscious is just not too good. You know, we're looking for the conscious. And we're missing all the unconscious stuff that happens between mother and child, father and child, where the baby learns to self-regulate by time with the parent. Time with the parent. And the whole role of the eyes with the parent. This colleague of mine who is a child therapist has been presenting all over the world, and she was presenting in Singapore. And Singapore is predominantly English-speaking among the educated people. And they asked her if she would work with a child, so she had no language barrier. And the child came in, and the child is disruptive and all the rest. And she said, in matters of minutes, just getting the child's eyes and holding the child's eyes, the child started to self-regulate with her. And why is that? Again, it has to do with brain formation. And that is that in the brain, there are, first of all, there are parts of the brain that are sensory motor, and that sensory motor neurons fire for the child whenever they see an adult do it. So if the adult does a calming motion, the child mirrors that. We talk a lot about mirroring children, which is important. The child goes, they go, you know, and we mirror them. But they're mirroring us. And those mirror neurons are the bases of the function of empathy. They're the first of all, they show a basic physical empathy by showing that the child is capable of doing a gesture they saw out there. Do you see how that moves one away from a kind of egocentricity to being a social animal? You know, and so if the mother is doing that, then the father, the child is echoing that, not even consciously, but that's giving a substrate in the child of there's more than one of us in the world, and they mirror back. There's a commercial on right now, which Don and I laugh a lot about, but it's one about in the presence of your child, don't do you know what it is? The child then slaps the table in imitation of the parent, but then it goes on and it has the child marrying somebody who wears a dog tag around their neck and giving a baby. I forgot my line of thought. I thought this would happen after a while. Okay, so let's go back to say to even that this sign thing and see, is there still some value to talking about the accumulation of all the things we need in the first half of life to know how to do? And I can read off a list of these. Can we say that that might well be interspersed with things we want to call second half of life things? And I thought, yeah, I know how I could do it. If I had a slinky, okay, I took a slinky here and I rolled it up against this and just pulled it out. You know how a slinky makes like a bunch of these waves, you know? So that we have a little slinky here. And so instead of having this smooth curve going up, we rather have one that has all of these oscillations going up. And along the line, there might be a rather big oscillation. As, you know, certainly happens in the lives of some children. You had mentioned about developmental theory in Jung. In the school of developmental theory, there are now three schools, the classical school, the developmental school, and the archetypal school. But the developmental school is largely the original work done in England. And they gave this view up a long time ago, saying that they have plenty of evidence in childhood and teens of a kind of like healthy ego surrender. You know, they said all of the things that could be said of the second half of life, you can in some way find some evidence, especially in a child that had a secure attachment, in a healthy way. I remember going through quite a few years of thinking that what was the trouble with me was that I had spent 20 years in the convent and I had been told to surrender my ego before I had one. And to some extent that was true. I mean, but to some extent there was no harm done. I mean, if I thought I was doing something for the third degree in humility, you know, I could only go as far as I could go, you know? And I guess what I've done is continue to look in some scientific neurology report to see if there is such a thing as precocious empathy or precocious altruism, you know, because I thought that being in the convent and being sort of so good and idealistic and all the rest meant that I didn't get enough time to strut in the convent, you know, and do all of those more obnoxious things. I now don't think that's the truth. I think that whatever that moment is that leads you maybe into the convent, you know, that moment that I think it's Matthew in the Gospel had when Jesus came and called him and he said, "You're calling me?" And he said, "I saw you under the fig tree." And people interpreted that Matthew had a moment of great generosity, great giving, and that Jesus was aware of that and said, "Come," you know. So that there might have been other reasons why we became nuns. Those of us, and I tell you, at my time, there were lots of us. In my novitiate, there were 72 people, you know? 70, yeah. It was huge. I entered in 1954. That was the heyday of religious vocations. We were coming in droves, you know? I guess I don't regret now that, like I did for a long time, that I did not have a more florid and youth. And on the other hand, maybe it was I just had to do some things in out of order. Yeah.
Could you comment on the importance of role models in our lives as we go through these journeys? One of the things that brings it to my mind is my wife Ruthie and I last night were watching Michelle Obama on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno, and the response to her was just an outpouring from the audience. She's so genuine, has a great sense of humor. She's a parent who has her children in mind at all times. She seems unstressed. She seems like a wonderful wife. She has her own agenda as First Lady. It appears that she has a balance in her life, and I thought, what a role model she is, how genuine she is, what a human being she is, and how people responded to her. And it seems like those are the kinds of people that we need in our lives at different times, in different ways. And how important is it that we have them, do you think?
Well, you know, first of all, thank you for the example. I think you know, really good example there. I think we can't underestimate it, and especially do you need that kind of interactive thing with the infant in the first years. I mean, when I see a mom rolling a pram and she has her cell phone on and she, you know, there's no joint discovery of the flowers or the trees, you know, they're on a very limited level, a role model. She's not being a role model for her child as to how to socialize, how to interact, how to discover the world together, you know. And I think that's, we suffer from that. But I think that part of what we do, you know, is to find people who do that for us. You know, and yes.
We have a responsibility, it seems like you're saying, to reach out and to find those people in our lives.
Yes, and then to also tell those people that they they've done something for us.
Yes.
You know, in that process. I see the time is just there. I want to finish one or two things. I have a whole section of building ego skills I want to get to. But first of all, what I do want to say is that there are three gestures I learned early about what a child needs or what anybody needs in the first half of life. And I think that they go for the whole of life. And the gestures are, first of all, this one, you know, rocking the baby, you know. And that would be the gesture I would put together with all the material from attachment theory, in which what you want is, you know, a secure attachment, in which most of what happens on the secure attachment is unconscious. And, you know, if that isn't there, then one has to find a place to get it. And personally, I find this is a place to get it.
Yeah.
Because there isn't a judgment here as to what you think, or do you match up, or, you know, are we going to heal you? There's just acceptance and warmth. And if, as a result of having a secure attachment, where, I'm going to see if I can find this, we can say, I am good, wanted, worthwhile, competent, and lovable. That's straight from attachment theory. I think we can say about that here. I'm good, I'm wanted, I'm worthwhile, I'm competent, and lovable. And what... yes. 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 Ooh. Is that from health? Yes. 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 Yeah. Yes. Christine was saying the lines from Help, where the black help that is said to the white, almost abandoned little child, "You are
kind,
you are
smart."
Yeah. 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 So that if we didn't have a lot of that, and incidentally, I had nannies. I grew up in the West Indies. You know, I don't. My sister told my mother when she had her babies, "I bet you never even changed a diaper once." I don't know if that's so, but you know, thank. You know, I resonated to that. I think we can seek out places that foster in us not only that kind of feeling about ourselves, but also ones that we can say about this place even more. Places that are not only safe, but stimulating, challenging, you know, encouraging to think as around the clock as we can, and then decide what we think for ourselves. So the first is this. The second gesture is this. Now, this is the one about the law. You know, it's having parallel hands, and it is to simulate the idea of the sides of a bridge. And so I would ask you to imagine going across the Royal Gorge by car or by walking if it had no railings on it. Okay? That's what it's like for children to go, or for ourselves really, to go through life without firm the law. You can see that Richard Rohr, in his long section on the law, really had as a population who serves those in prison. You know, for many of us, if you read the chapter, you perhaps at the place where the Japanese said, "You're not a warrior any longer," you know, farewell to the warrior self. But if we've internalized the idea of giving ourselves railings that increase the likelihood of our going forward, rather than impede. So it's like railings rather than hurdles. But so much, somehow or the other, whether it's the church or the state, they give young people hurdles, you know, and it's all very well if they take a hurdle, you know, because you want to be a hurdle runner, you know, that's all very well, but not for everybody. So railings, and imaginally, I like to think that when we set up for ourselves goals, we ask ourselves, what are the railings I put in place so I'll have safe conduct to the other side of the canyon? And then the third of these gestures is this. I have my hands up and stretched out in blessing. And it is, you can leave now. You don't have to take care of me, you know, the parent to the child. And hopefully the child will come back and be with the parent voluntarily in equality, but to leave. And I know how difficult in my various therapies it was for me to leave when I wasn't getting anything I wanted. It was very hard, especially in therapy, should there be this gesture, you know, you can go now, you're okay, or you can go now. I've taught you what I can teach, all right, whatever. So let's go and have, and we'll come back for discussion.